A lot of us here at Central Time enjoy a good work of science fiction or fantasy every now and then, and sometimes you wonder whether or not the stuff in these books and movies could actually happen in real life.
Well, our next guest decided to take it one step further. In a new book, he looks at popular works of science fiction and fantasy through the lens of physics and math. And by applying real-life formulas to some of the scientific questions that these works pose, he tries to figure out what could be reality and what's just out of this world.
Charles Adler joins us now. He's a professor of physics at St. Mary's College of Maryland and the author of Wizards, Aliens, and Starships, Physics and Math in Fantasy and Science Fiction. Charles, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me here.
Well, you're a physicist and you grew up as a fan of science fiction. What made you want to put those two together and apply the scientific lessons you knew to the fiction you were reading?
Well, I actually started as a scientist because I read science fiction. I started reading the science fiction first and got interested in science because of all these, you know, strange and neat ideas like space travel or, you know, artificial intelligence, things like that, in meeting aliens in the science fiction books that I was reading, and it led me into science. But as I started learning more and more science, I started to realize that a lot of the science portrayed in science fiction stories wasn't all that accurate. And so I started thinking about what was more realistic and wasn't realistic. And so I kind of brought it all together again when I started looking at this book. It's a book I've been thinking about quite literally since I was about 15 years old.
As someone who's a fan of science fiction and fantasy, and also, you know, the math and you know the physics, do you get more out of these works of sci-fi and fantasy by knowing the math and the underpinnings beneath them?
Sure. I think knowing more helps you enjoy them more. I mean, my daughters will sometimes look at me and say, well, why are you spoiling the story for us, Dad? But I actually do think that thinking about it more helps you enjoy it more. You know, I won't say that I will expect every piece of science fiction to be completely accurate and that I won't enjoy it unless it is. But I think it does add something to the story to see where it is accurate and to actually enjoy a story that's, you know, well-crafted and where people have actually been thinking about the science in it.
Well, what surprised me was you don't start off with science fiction. You start off with Harry Potter, a fantasy thing. And usually with fantasy, you think, oh, that doesn't make sense. Oh, well, it's magic. But you are looking at least for some sort of internal consistency and some obedience to scientific principles, even with the magic. Why?
Well, because if you look at it, there are actually a large number of fantasy writers who do pay attention to that sort of thing. Poole Anderson, for example, who is better known as a science fiction writer, did write several fantasy novels in which he actually did pay attention to some, not all the laws of science, but some of the laws of science, like, for example, the law of conservation of mass. He paid attention to these, and I think it kind of enriched the stories because it kind of put boundaries on what the people in the stories could do and couldn't do. I love the Harry Potter stories, but you do sometimes get a sense that J.K. Rowling was sort of making up the rules as she went along. You know, there are a number of things in the stories which you look at and you start thinking, well, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense here. For example, I mean, in the third book, they give, you know, a time machine, you know, for crying out loud, to the equivalent of a high school student in order for her to take more class.
Right, in the form of what? It's a watch, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's a watch. It could get easily lost. Someone could pick it up and start using it for their own purposes. Even if not, the potential is that, you know, she could do a whole lot of damage just by using a time machine there. And so, you know, it's there to provide a story, provide a plot point for the story, but it doesn't make a lot of sense when you view it, you know, kind of in a larger context.
Well, let's dig into some of the other science that you just mentioned in passing there, mass conservation. Now, this is something that involves a plot line where Draco Malfoy gets turned into a ferret.
Always with the ferrets on this show.
Yeah.
So tell me, how does that go over scientifically?
Not that well, because there's this law we call the conservation of mass energy. It's the most famous formula in physics, E equals mc squared. You can't get rid of mass. You can convert it into energy, or a better way of saying it might be that mass is a form of energy in some sense, but it can be converted at a very, very high price. 90,000 trillion joules for every kilogram of matter, about, you know, 2 pounds or so of matter, that you turn into energy. And put that in context, that's enough for every kilogram that you do. That's enough energy to power the United States, all of its energy needs, for about 8 hours. So if you think about turning Draco into a ferret, if all that excess mass gets released as energy, that's something like the equivalent of 10 hydrogen bombs going off all at once. So you start thinking about these things, you think, well, you know, every time that something gets turned into something else, you know, Hogwarts ought to be flattened by an atomic bomb, the equivalent of an atomic bomb explosion.
That may have been a tough plot point to work around there.
Right. And so you can think of lots of fun things like this. I mean, you start thinking, you know, E equals MC squared can actually get you very, very far with a lot of these things. You know, if you remember the Enterprise, for example, in Star Trek, going to a science fiction example, the Enterprise is powered by, you know, matter-antimatter reactions.
Sounds like Scanny.
Yeah. And so, you know, the idea is very simple. You take matter and you take antimatter in equal quantities and you toss them together and they convert themselves, you know, you annihilate the matter and antimatter into pure energy, you know, essentially light in the form of very, very, very high energy X-rays, gamma rays, as we typically call them. And you can actually use that to move a starship forward. It's a very, very effective way of doing it. There were actually serious proposals back in the 1980s by a scientist, not coincidentally also a science fiction writer, named Robert Forward, to actually create matter and antimatter to use as fuel for starships, for spaceships. The problem is that antimatter doesn't really exist in the real universe in any large quantities. We produce tiny, tiny, tiny bits of it in particle accelerators all over the world, but at the equivalent cost of something like trillions of dollars per pound at today's energy prices. And when you're talking about something like the USS Enterprise, you're talking about, you know, many millions of pounds of starship fuel that you'd need to power the spaceship. So you're looking at costs in fueling this thing of like trillions upon trillions of dollars, again, simply because it, you know, again, simply because of this idea of the conservation of mass and energy. You have to be able to, you know, if you want to create antimatter out of nothing, you have to spend an enormous amount of energy to do it.
Well, on a little closer to Earth, where are those flying cars that the science fiction authors were promising us? Why aren't those more plausible?
Well, I think for a couple of reasons. Number one, I think that one of the problems involved with that is that the fuel costs get very high. If you start looking at the cost, the fuel costs for, say, putting a regular, you know, a Toyota Corolla, something equivalent to that, in the air, you start talking about much, much, much larger engines. Flight is actually pretty energy expensive. If you start talking about, you know, driving a car down and putting, you know, having it pull out wings, like in James Bond stories, and having it take off into flight, it turns out that it actually, in order to overcome the drag forces on the car, it actually and keep it up in the air, it needs to exert a lot of energy. And as you make the car bigger, the energy costs actually scale disproportionately with the weight. It does turn out to be not very fuel economical in terms of fuel to actually get a car to fly. You also have the problem, of course, that you know, if you run out of fuel in a car, for example, you can pull off to the side of the road. But doing the same thing in a flying car is not so much fun.
Well, then there's the question of the other drivers. I mean, it's bad enough working in two dimensions sometimes.
True. Right, exactly. And training them and all, you know, I think driver's ed becomes a lot more difficult at that point as well, if you want to get people in. I think there have been some serious issues. There's some serious proposals that I've read about recently actually using computers to control the flight in the cars. You wouldn't have these, you know, issues with the drivers. But I think the fuel costs are still going to do it in the end.
Charles, just real quick, in our last moment of time here, what is the coolest thing that you found that actually is plausible in science fiction?
The coolest thing I found that's actually plausible in science fiction, I will say it's kind of on the border of plausibility. I'm a little dismissive of it in the book because I'm not sure exactly how it worked, but I love the idea of the space elevator. The idea of, you know, a transport system to space, which would actually involve taking a satellite and stretching it out, you know, so that one end goes up into space, the other end goes toward the ground, keeping the center of gravity in an orbit that stays at one point above the Earth's, or above the Earth's surface at all times, and stretching it to the point where it'll actually, one end will touch the ground, the other end will go out to space. You can actually literally ride an elevator out into space. And it seems to be just barely, what I love about the idea is that based on kind of materials issues. It seemed to be just barely plausible.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Charles, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Charles Adler, professor of physics at St. Mary's College of Maryland, author of Wizards, Aliens, and Starships.